This is MetaDama, a holistic view on data management in the Nordics. Welcome, my name is Winfried and thanks for joining me for this episode of MetaDama. Our vision is to promote data management as a profession in the Nordics, show the competencies that we have, and that is the reason I invite Nordic experts in data and information management for a talk.
Welcome to the latest episode of MetaDama. And I'm really happy to have with me another data hero from Denmark, Sten Rasmussen. Welcome, Sten.
Thank you, Winfried. I'm really pleased to be here. I love that you reached out and gave me this chance to share my thoughts.
And Sten brought with him a really interesting topic. So we're going to talk about the business implications of data ethics. And that's a huge topic. So is more really more? What are the implications of data for business on the one side and data ethics on the other side? So does a focus on data ethics have an impact on our business outcome? And why is it so hard for some CEOs and some companies to get that thinking of data ethics applied to their organization? Why does it seem strange, seem distant? And there are other topics like thinking in legal silos, compliance silos, data silos, and not really connecting those. And I think Sten has a lot of focus on those parts, and especially the business outcome part, to ensure that we actually reach our goals with the work we are doing on analytics. So first of all, Sten, please feel free to introduce yourself.
Yeah, sure. Sten Rasmussen, senior partner and co-founder of IH Nordic. Today, having the magnificent kind of abstract title, Director of Data Innovation. But we can go back to that, but that's where I see part of my challenge. I've been working with online data and measurement of websites and analytics since 1999. That makes me experienced. Old, would some say, but I just prefer experienced. So we are 50, 60 people based out of Copenhagen that works in helping companies activate their data to the benefit of their customers, kind of the soft story. Hobby-wise, well, I guess I have between 2 and 4 kids and a dog and a wife, so that takes a lot of time. Besides being an avid data evangelist, I spend most of my weekends, I feel, traveling or sharing or out spreading the gospel about how to think commercially with data. Because I think, my experience is that there's a lot of people out there who knows how to track. There's not necessarily the same amount of people who knows what to do with the data once they have it. So having that kind of agenda saying, now you have it, what are you going to do with it, makes me interesting to some people, especially in organizations saying, I think today there's no organization out there that says, hey, we need more data. Well, first stop is basically saying, what the hell are we going to do with the data we already have? And we'll get back to that conversation. But it really ties into to this commercial aspect. How did I get interested in data? I have a background in corporate communication, and that was fine. I actually started as an online copywriter. And my first job was for a Danish agency that later got acquired by a Swedish agency called Adera. And that was wonderful, except they had the slowest intranet in the world. So I was sitting very often waiting for this intranet to load the next page. And because I was a geek and I had a business background as part of my education, I start wondering, saying, okay, how much time are we really wasting inside this organization that is paid by the hour for selling their time? So I started doing the math, saying, okay, we're 800 people in this organization. And on average, we spend 5 minutes, we waste between 5 and 10 minutes per person every day waiting for this intranet. So that kind of showed me how expensive it was to not be aligned. And then on the other hand, it was also with that kind of sparked the interest of saying, what is actually the commercials implication of not looking at your data? So that was kind of my entry into it. It was pain learned me, taught me to look at. So I hope that was an inspiring anecdote from the real world where a lot of us honestly still suffer.
Fantastic. Yeah, and this is what the podcast is about, right? Get those frustrations out.
Yeah, exactly. So, but this is like, it's almost 25 years ago, and I think it has become fastest, because otherwise it's like unacceptable.
And let's hope that you are spot on. If we collect data, we need to do something about it. And I've been talking about that in several previous episodes, the term dark data. When we collect data that we don't really need and we don't really know what we collected it for, there are liabilities with that. We have data that we don't have control of. We don't know what we have. So we can't really tell if anyone hacks in the data, changes the data, alters the data. But there's so many implications of that. So if we collect data, we also need to make sure that, well, the data management part have control of that data, but also use it for an effect. And I think you have been a fantastic ambassador in exactly that field.
And it's really a part of a curse as well, in the sense, I think, over time, when we've been talking to customers, we often ask customers the questions, so what would you like us to track? And since people are kind of a mix of opportunists that don't want to, they want to have the opportunity to do anything and not necessarily knowing what options they have, the really easy answer to give, if say, hey, Winfred, what do you want me to track? Then your answer would be, well, Steen, everything, right? So you kind of get this that matches your scope. We have no idea what we have. We have everything. So I guess it's good and evil and everything. And since we don't have a point to why we have it because we might want to use it someday for something, then we might need everything. But the curse of that on the flip side, that I feel a lot of data agencies and analysts and businesses as well is suffering under now, is the cost of maintaining tracking everything. So the budget load is actually very often on the side of tracking and not on the side of activation, because we try to track everything. So that's kind of the first commercial curse I see, that we're in a place where we are too ambitious in our tracking in relation to what we plan to get out of it.
I still really like the term root, which in Norwegian means clutter, right? Disorder.
Yeah.
But it's actually short for redundant, obsolete, trivial.
Yeah.
And a lot of the information that companies collect is root.
Yeah.
And you can't really use it for anything, but it actually clutters your way in using and getting value out of the data that you actually could get.
Oh, absolutely. And if you even have a scenario where you have gathered the data out for some ambitions, so what you get is sometimes you get this, then you get a change in the direction. The person responsible with the tracking leaves, another person comes in, and they like tracking a different way. So they clutter the clutter. So they actually, and all the historical value you could have from it that would have been there, the continuity of understanding of what's going on, is being abrupted, and you basically just, well, let's start cluttering over. But you keep the old clutter because, well, we might need that too someday. We don't know what it is, and I have no idea if I like it, but I want my clutter.
I popped right into the topic, which is fantastic. But let's take it one step back and talk a bit more about high-level data and marketing and sales. And marketing and sales are maybe the most data-savvy or data-thirsty business units, where you have a great need for insights, analytics, and data. And you have had that for quite some time. And I think for many companies, actually marketing and sales that was driving the agenda for becoming data-driven or data-informed. So would you say there's more experience in the field of data in marketing and sales?
I think maybe there's a better commercial understanding in relation to pushing that agenda, because it's like, well, if you go to the CFO and ask if he has data, I'm pretty sure that he will say he has pretty good data, right? And if you go to that head of logistics, he'll probably say the same time, and the person running production. What they might not have is in relation to the market. And I think that's the extra dimension that can be added with the next level of thinking in relation to the specific impact of marketing activities on the internal structures and on the bottom line. The old saying about half of your marketing budget is wasted, you just don't know which half. Well, if you're still wasting half of your marketing budget, then you're definitely not doing it right. Because either even wasted budget should be used to understand that it was wasted. So you have this insight dimension now that is not just about driving business, but also driving knowledge. And pushing that double agenda is probably the new thing from sales and marketing. Being able to leverage and dive into the data as an opportunity to come out wiser. I don't see the CFO gambling with new financial structures just for the heck of it.
Yeah, I think this is something that we've seen in different fields that drive for knowledge. And you can actually see that there's some change in the mindset of how you use data. And we classically talked about that data, information, knowledge, wisdom pyramid, right? How much contextualization do we need for data to actually gain knowledge to the business or to the organization?
Mm.
I think marketing has an advantage here in doing that, because you get that, exactly as you said, the relation to the market. So you get that market context and that internal knowledge.
I think it's valuable in saying that the key thing that you get from the data in the marketing and sales space is really that it's in relation to the product and the turnover and the direct relationship to the people there, right? So we can have an amazing streamlined business with logistic, but if there's no market, or we're shipping products the wrong places where the market isn't, then that's a problem, no matter how cheap we can do it. And so having this ability to determine and interact with markets so we can actually update and align products in relation to demand, that's an amazing perspective in this. I think the challenge when it comes to this, if we will talk about, does it make marketing and sales data better? And I think in a lot of contexts, it doesn't. It does in the sense that there's some more direct data, but our history in using it is still so, we're still on a frontier in relation to what does it actually mean. So there's a lot, if you go to 10 different organizations and look at how they handle the data and what they do with it, they might be doing 10 different things and they have 10 different processes. And if you go to 5 different agencies and tell them, hey, analyze my data, they might come up with 8 different interpretations, right? So there's this scientific expectation we have because we're working with data. It's not really there yet because the area is so young that we're still learning. So having the challenge of actually going in and saying, "Fool, if we often get this marketing mix modeling thing where people talk about, yeah, I would like to know how should I spread my budget so I get the optimal return." And that's really a wonderful ambition. But the problem is that I use this term a lot now, I'm maybe overusing it, but we're trying to put a fixed measure on a moving target because the market is a living entity. It changes its needs and demands. If you travel back in time and find the hottest footwear in 1999, in your marketing strategy, even if you use the best marketing mix model today, it might not mean that you would sell one single pair of footwear, right? So the needs and changes because we're talking about people. So having this saying, we're trying to do science against the soft target, that's really one of the challenges that makes it difficult to communicate. And if people have this saying, okay, cool, no, I just want the formula. Well, I can give you the perfect formula for yesterday, but there's a good chance that it will suck tomorrow. You need to adjust and rethink and gather and interpret all the time. Does that make sense? Is that...
That makes total sense. And especially when we talk about trend prediction. And I had, in the last episode, we talked with H&M about their trend prediction and how they use terms in social media to actually design clothes and lines accordingly, which is really interesting. But this goes exactly on the point you are making. How can we use data to predict those trends also in marketing?
Yep. And I think it's really interesting. And we can do a lot of behavioral forecasting, but the further we push it into the future, the more uncertain it becomes, right? So if you travel back in time just 1 year saying, cool, what is the landscape going to look like? And then you would have you will do like linear forecast based on the past. And then somebody launches ChatGPT and Midjourney and all these things. And then it's like, okay, I'm not really that good at looking into the future, apparently. Because we just get, the reality gets disrupted by itself. Very poor thinking.
But I like it, yeah.
Well,
but now you're actually moving into the main topic, basically, talking about how do we do trend prediction? Well, we use behavioral data, we use cultural data to kind of see what is coming. But with GDPR, with privacy laws, we are going towards, well, what data can we actually use in our models? And then you have to think of that at the ethics aspect.
Yeah, but I think it's perfect timing in the sense that, what was it, 1,000 scientists that came out this morning with with a shared warning against they wanted to put research on AI on the hold for the next 6 months because they talked about, I heard Gary Marcos from NYU talking about this being a perfect storm in relations to so many moving parts, but one of the drivers was corporate irresponsibility. And I like the term in the sense that, what is the corporate responsibility? If you go into the Norwegian Stock Exchange and then you find all the companies registered there, all of them will say, well, their responsibility is first to the shareholders, right? So what is corporate responsibility and what is corporate irresponsibility? And I like that the thinking in the sense that if we start thinking beyond just the shareholders, what is the responsibility and how can we actually reflect on that in relations to the difference we make and the consequences of the thinking we have on the long run, right? And that's where I see this need for something bigger when it comes to ethics, that data right now is becoming a bigger and bigger cannon. And if we're just firing it for commercial purposes, the consequences and the negative consequences on the bigger level is something that we need to consider.
Oh, yes, definitely. And I think there has been too much focus on short-term return of investment. And as you said, well, let's keep the stakeholders happy, and not enough focus on what does that mean long-term for how we are perceived as a company. Mm. And these are the problems we have seen with Meta. These are the problems we have seen with Google. And these are the problems we are starting to see in Europe as well. And I think there is a certain difference between the US and their standard on privacy and what we have in Europe, definitely. But you kind of see some aspects of that here as well.
Yeah, absolutely. In the sense that, I did a presentation a couple of years ago. I called it Infants with Guns. And it was really trying to push the agenda in relation to saying that this goes to the analytics community as well, that sometimes we will get involved with projects for the sake of the project. It's an interesting data project. So, my favorite example is if I roll back and if I had gone back in time and somebody had come to me and said, hey, Steen, listen, we have access to a lot of Facebook data and we would like to kind of use that for supporting marketing so we're able better to meet people's needs so we can determine the right product for the right time. And I would say, oh my God, that sounds like a really interesting project. And suddenly it's me building Cambridge Analytica, right? Because I don't see the full potential of what this thing I'm building can also be used for. It's just a data project in relation to doing better and more qualified marketing. Well, it does have some extra firepower in there that can be used for manipulating elections and changing hearts and minds of people based on my prejudice, right? So being aware of this, saying that data projects for a long time has been theoretical in the sense that, sure, it's been good at talking about all these things, but it has not really been able to be used in the real world. But now we're in a place where the technological power is there to actually make stuff happen. We data can make things happen. And it goes back to the conversation of ChatGPT now and this type of tools saying, okay, cool. Why the scientist came out with the warning saying, yeah, it's a black box. We don't exactly know what's going on in there. And should we empower that even more with firepower and intelligence and a will to act and intention? Maybe we should just stop for a while and just think about what we're doing. And it's not about being pessimistic. It's just about reflecting on the consequences of what we do.
Yeah, I really like that. And there's the big question in the room, and it's been a question for years now, especially since GDPR. Should and could that be regulated by law, or should we rather go for company-specific measures, data governance in companies ramping up to tackle those issues?
And I think it's an amazing complicated discussion, right? Because on one hand, we have the market, right? And the first person to the market with an idea or concept will get a benefit. So there's a business value in being first. And so there's a arms race in relations to getting your stuff to the market first. You can just see the discussion now between the ChatGPT and Bard, that everybody, Google lost because the other were first. it might be more complicated about that, but just the race in relation to getting out there and what Google will do to catch up and how much they will push now. But this on one hand, but then you then saying, well, should we try to regulate it? But when I look at the, and this might be me not being enough updated, but like the Danish Ethical Council that goes in and evaluates, well, they meet, what, 4-6 times a year to discuss a subject. I guess probably right now they're catching up to 2007 or something in relation to the list of issues. So because the speed of innovation is just cranking up, so it's really difficult to have this thing. And even if they come out and say, yes, this should be regulated, okay, then we have to put down a committee to decide how it should be regulated. And then it has to go to a vote in parliament to that how it's supposed to be regulated. And then it's like, yes, we all agree that telefaxes should be regulated, but it's already obsolete. It's gone. It's like, congratulations, we're considering regulating something that is already has been there and left again. Yeah, I hope I'm not getting too philosophical in your Winfried.
No, well, I love to be a bit philosophical about those things because that's where we are now in the stage, right? We have to think about this in a higher perspective than just setting a simple data contract or a simple data usage agreement for one data set. We have to think of it as a whole and see, look at the consequences and the consequences we're not seeing yet.
Yeah, but then it's an amazing dilemma, right? Because on one hand, this is one of the things that I try to, when I talk to people saying we need, or you need as a company, you need a set of data ethical guidelines saying, how do we use data? What is our principle around data use? How will we use it in our organization? And there's two problems with that, because one is who should define these ethical guidelines in the organization, right? Because right now it's, what we see, it's very much on the user level is the people having access to the data that is given the responsibility for ethical use. But on the top level, we have management that has another interest in relation to looking at the competitors who does not have an ethical guideline and say, cool, apparently right now we're being outcompeted by somebody who is not doing this and we don't need to do this. So maybe we should just bend the rules so we can stay in the game. It's difficult, David. It's a challenge for people to say, well, we would rather go under as a company than break data ethical guidelines and then leave it to the bastard that doesn't have any to own the market. So on a short-term basis, it's a really competitive, complicated situation that is principle-driven, but the people who's defining whether we should do it or not are not necessarily the people who will have to live with the consequence. So I think that's damn interesting. So I think it's good that we have these things in relations to, and then like GDPR, the overall guidance in relation to having some principle that is being defined by top level that is super. They might be commercially complicated because then we're looking outside the European Union and then European companies are competing with companies in other markets that are not working under these rules. So suddenly the complication goes somewhere else. So ideally, and this is highly unlikely, we need global set of data ethical guidelines saying these are the limits we will not cross. And pushing against that, we have commercial interest. So I think it's, what's the UK term? It's a bit of a pickle.
Definitely. And we kind of established the need for data to actually get to the business outcome going forward and the value of it. And I think you're totally right. There's a set of ethical standards and guidelines that we should adopt to. And I don't know in what way they have to be written, how free they should be. That's a different discussion. But against that, they push its business interest.
Mm.
But for some companies, they see more and more the value of data ethics, also from the business side, in, for example, being more trustworthy as a company for the customers, being more secure, having a better legal standing when it comes to legal obligations. So do you see any trend there that people see the value of data ethics, also the business value?
So absolutely. And I think it's one of the reasons why I'm pushing it, because I see right now we're in a gray zone, but when we come out on the other side of this, it'll basically be for us as consumers, there'll be three types of companies. There'll be the companies we trust, that we give access to our data. There will be the companies we might trust that will give access to a little data, and there will be the companies we don't trust that will try to block everything from, right? So suddenly it's becoming if we have the feeling, if you have the feeling that this company cannot be trusted with your data, they will violate it, sell it to third parties, use it against you, then you will not share your data with them and you will actually be less likely to do business with them. There need to be some really strong incentives for you to engage with a company like that. Whereas on the other side, companies where you trust them with your data, you will be much more likely to give them more data to enhance your value and to enhance your life. So this is the long-term value of data ethics, that you as a company actually becomes much closer to the consumers and you can actually use this data to understand the market, where the companies with no trust will be flying much more blind and have to work much more like in the old days, where it's mainly just guessing in relation to what demands are there, or buying the even more suspicious data from suspicious sources.
I totally agree with you, but there is another aspect to it, right? And in many cases, you are more or less forced to share your data if you want to use a service, right? So it's the attractiveness of the service that makes you choose to share your data, not how you trust that company. Facebook, best example for that. I've had a chat with someone previously on the podcast, and she had a startup company that had the goal to give people back ownership of their personal data. So that you can decide yourself, who am I going to sell my data to? And who am I not going to sell my data to?
And I like it. And then around 2008-09, we had a lot of, there was a couple of startups in the US that was actually looking into the similar field. So they wanted to say, cool, your data is your data. So going in and then saying, if you want to sell your data, so you come in with your, in the browser, in the browser, you have like, you put prices on certain data points. And you could go and say, put rules in relation to who could buy what. And what happened was actually that all these startups got acquired by the US data broker to get them out of the way, because that was a major hassle for their business. This is the interesting thing, because I share the vision. I would love to give people control of their data and giving ownership. That's why I say anything being legal is table stakes. This is where we need to be. Ethics comes on top of that. But the challenge again is that there might be commercial interest in the data itself, saying that in a lot of markets, data is a commodity on the same level as ketchup. There's big money being made in buying and selling data. So data brokerage as an industry is actually massively lobby against this. This is the challenge. So there's a commercial interest pushing against this. And this is where the politicians need to step into the equation. But if you look at what the National Rifle Association has been able to do in the US when it comes to gun ownership, there could be a similar situation coming up here.
But especially in this relationship between an individual and data brokerage, it's not an even balanced challenge, right?
No.
And there's another aspect to it, and I'm trying to get to the root cause of it. In my mind, it's about that personal data literacy that we talked about. Do people actually understand, A, the value of the data they own, but also the implications of sharing that data?
And honestly, in most people, they don't. Most situations, they don't. It's the classic situation. You run out to any school and ask them, saying, hey, is it a problem that TikTok has your data? Is it a problem Facebook has your data? That, nah, I don't have any secrets. It's just data. It doesn't matter, right? But it does, and I think that's probably a challenge with the speed of change. Making sure people are aware of that data literacy is something that we should be aware of and concern ourselves with. But if you go out and do that survey and you can ask them, are you happy with Facebook having your data? They will say, yeah, it doesn't matter. Okay, how annoyed are you with cookie banners? Oh, I hate them. Right? So you can get this kind of pseudo self-sabotage that people are not even aware that the measures being put in place for their benefit, that they just get annoyed with them. It's like people being angry over saying, why is there a law that says I have to wear a seatbelt? It hampers my free choice.
No, exactly. I've seen a clip not that long ago about when the US or some states in the US started to have a no drinking and driving policy. So it's kind of the same.
Yeah.
Why do you limit my freedom
yeah.
in drinking while driving? For your own benefit.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And I think the challenge is, and this is going to put it bluntly, right? But sometimes, yeah, listen, I'm sorry, I'm going to limit your few, your free thinking because you're not qualified in this case to do free thinking. You're stupid when you drink. So I'm going to limit that, right? It's not like if we did the big list of human choices that we made through our lives, is they, all of them are really all equally clever.
Well, they can think of some there that are not.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, my six-year-old started school, and first class, they got their Chromebook in Norway. And I've seen that the data protection authorities in Denmark have, for example, put a stop to using Chromebooks in schools.
Yeah, but it's interesting because I also saw the municipality in Stockholm said they shouldn't use Office 360 because it was something similar in relation to data. So it's such a complication, right? Because if we push this thing to the extreme end, who can we share our data with? And what are the alternatives? If you say, okay, cool, I want to move my kids to a safe environment so they cannot use any US-based software solution because the data might be compromised. So can you give me what operating platform would they be using? What were the word processing platforms would they be using? What email client could they be using and so on? It's we haven't been good in Europe at preparing this, right? So we don't have any good alternative. And for a lot of the brands that are there, they would probably break their neck if all the European countries suddenly changed to some platform that was actually inside the EU. It's like, okay, suddenly, oh my God, that's a lot of customers coming there. They would probably have to move to some American infrastructure to be able to scale. And then nothing changed. So what do you feel is the situation in Norway? Do you see any trends in relation to data ethic? Because I have some good companies in Denmark that I use as example. Like Tivoli has a strong data ethics set. Lego has a massive data ethics set. And I have other companies that I use as examples. Do you have anybody in Norway where you would say these are the front runners when it comes to data ethics?
There's a lot of discussion about data ethics in Norway, and we have had a fantastic event in January where we talked about data ethics and handling of data in AI models and algorithms by some companies step forward. So yes, there's a lot of great work been done, but I think there's still a bit of a mind shift that has to happen. I think there are a lot of ambassadors out there who talk about data ethics and talk about the importance of it, but still, companies think, well, that's not for me. It's not my concern. I'm just producing industrial data. I don't really need that, right? I don't work with people. I don't work with right. And then you start that discussion. But the definition we put out for data ethics in the Data Management Association is do right when nobody's looking. I think that's the important part here. It's not about doing right when the authorities have their finger on you, not about doing right when you are actually in a compliance issue, but doing right when nobody's looking. And that's what actually builds that trustworthy basis.
Yeah, but I think it's a good definition. I think, but often the challenge is also saying the culture aspect, because that's the challenge. You can just say, cool, then yeah, okay, fine, here, and then we have the dark ops department that goes in and do all our dirty work, but the company is 99.9% clean, except we have these really bandits over in the corner that goes in and do all our dirty work, right? So everybody has to do it, and then it becomes something that can only be defined from the top. We cannot have. I like the simplicity in the definition. But I bet if you gathered 15 people and told them what it meant to do, what it means to do right, that then you would also get variations in what you could actually do to do right.
Yeah. And we talked about this right at the start. There's something about handling ethics on a company level, and most companies do that in trying to connect ethical decisions to their company values. But when you split up between departments, there will be a difference because every department handles different data sets, have a different approach on their data, and see a different importance of ethics.
Yeah.
I mean, HR department has an entirely different view on on how they're working with their data than the finance department or the marketing department.
Yeah.
How do you handle that? How do you encompass the entire company?
Man, I think it's complicated. Well, it's almost impossible because it's still early days. It's like when I talked about how we use data and how people interpret data differently. And I think the part of the challenge is saying we need to enforce like a corporate guideline that is from the top, like our corporate social responsibility guidelines. There needs to be a data ethical guidelines at the same level that people can refer to. And then the whistleblower agreement and everything, all the stops we have in other areas needs to be moved into this area as well. But I think the shift is also somewhere else. The shift, and where we see this when we talk about Google Analytics now, is saying that for us, it's not about how much we can track, it's about how little. So actually, data management becomes much easier if we focus on how little data do we actually need, because then we can focus on the simplicity of things, that we have a lot less data points and a lot less ethical decisions to make. So reversing the thinking and saying, what is our minimal requirement? What do we actually need to survive? And then we can start saying, then everything on top of that becomes an ethical question. So should we do that or not? So simplifying first and then adding on top of that would be a good part of my answer. Is it easy? Hell no. But can it be done? There is.
2017, I wrote an article about data minimization, and this is exactly it. Well, then related to the principles in GDPR.
Mm.
But yeah, you need to limit the data you're actually collecting, creating as early as possible at that data lifecycle stage.
Yeah.
But when you start limiting the data in a later stage, you already had it in your system.
Yeah.
And this is basically what we're doing, right? We are collecting it, and then at one point, a bit later in the stage, we are actually looking at it and say, what do we actually need at all?
Yeah.
So we have to push that decision right at the start.
And it also makes it a lot easier when we talk about Google Analytics and the different interpretations. You're saying now that we are facing a migration to GA4 for a lot of companies, well, the situation is saying, if you're not tracking everything, if this is the end of everything, what do you actually need to track? So, and what is the risk of having that in the US? If you have a minimal number of data points, is that a problem? So sure, it's a problem if I want to track 10,000 variables about everybody, because then it can be combined, and then it can be technically de-anonymized, because we have this pseudo-anonymization where we can combine the points. But if we have fewer points, then it simply becomes impossible to decouple, right? So that mission, I think, is really interesting. In our work with Google Analytics has really been about combining what the tool does with the idea of what is the intent of the law. The intent of the law is not to prohibit companies from looking at what's happening on their website. It's a business channel. We need to see we invest some money in marketing. We need to be able to see how that marketing performs. And as long as we can do that without violating or compromising the individual, then I think then we're not breaking the law. And I know there's a big difference between Northern European and Southern European approach to this. And I had some good discussions with somebody talking about the difference between relative law in the Nordics, where we talk about is this just and fair and is it reasonable, and Napoleonic law in Southern Europe, saying that my favorite quote was, one of my staffs got met with when they talked about relative. They got this post back from somebody saying, the law is the law and the law must be obeyed, which is kind of a Judge Dredd approach in my world, saying the law can always be discussed. And if we cannot discuss the law, then we're not living in a democracy. The law should be relative to the people and not defining the people the other way around. So that's my approach.
And the law is also under a constant development.
Yeah, because
things are changing. You had an article about Google Analytics and ethics and how it has been handled differently by data protection authorities in different countries, also in the Nordics. Norway had an entirely different approach to that than Denmark. Why is that?
It's because there is no... everybody is giving a framework and then they're being asked to interpret it in their own way. And of course, and I know when I talk to them, and I've talked to a lot of the DPAs, they kind of lean on each other so they don't look completely split in relation to what their opinion is. So a lot of it is still based on the original first interpretation from Austria and then added from there. But people try to wriggle a bit. The challenge is that also, and this is, you can side that on a personal note, I think a lot of them don't really understand the technology. So it becomes kind of vague and intentional in relationship. So you need to understand the technology and what it's supposed to do and not just generalize. It's like with the first thing is they all talk about they all talk about Google Analytics, but there's no such thing, right? It's like talking about, Toyota cars should be illegal because they pollute. But there's also electric Toyota cars that do not pollute. But we're just going in and saying Toyota because, yeah, that's the easy thing, right? So this interpretation in relation to what the platforms actually do and how they work and how they can be limited. And I think for us, we've been spending a lot of time trying to look across these different interpretations and have actually done something where we feel we have a solution where we make Google Analytics legal, that it is tracking within the compliance and the frameworks of what is supposed to happen. But it's because we come from a culture where we're looking at saying Google Analytics has not been declared illegal anywhere. All the DPAs have said if it comes to a court case, this would most likely be the outcome and that would be their recommendations, but they're only advising on it. So it's not illegal anywhere. So unless you know something, I don't know. But
it's always easier to generalize than to actually go into detail and try to differentiate out what the problems actually are.
Yeah, but it just creates a panic. There's a lot of companies out there that are saying, oh my God, it's illegal. We don't want to be illegal. And then somebody mentioned, yeah, you can get fined this amount of money for violating GDPR. And like, oh my God, we have Google Analytics and it could cost us billions and billions of kronas. And it's like, well, not really. That's not how the system works, dude. Calm down. Sit down, have a cup of tea, and let's try and talk about it. But there's a lot of people running around out there with their arms over their head, just screaming in panic, removing tools. That is not the problem. Right? So having this approach saying, if I look at the data I have in there first, what am I doing with it? What is the quality of the data? What do I need it for? Then in a lot of cases, people will find that Google Analytics is actually the best alternative to Google Analytics and that it's not illegal. So having this compliance thinking as part of the baseline saying everything is compliant. I think even the Danish DPA said, well, Google Analytics is not more illegal than any other tool out there. It's just the only one we looked at. So we have, they'd have just, and again, going back to the ethical departments, they just haven't had time. There's so much technology out there. So everything will be evaluated sooner or later. So where should you move if you move? There might be solutions that are okay, but it's necessarily any better than that.
Thank you. We're already closing into the end of it. What I take with me here from that great talk we had about ethics is that we are on a journey towards something here. We talked about in the 60s, 70s when they stopped allowing drinking and driving in the US. You had to wear your seatbelts in the 70s. I've seen that example from all the oil and gas companies I worked for. And in every meeting room, there's a sign that says, these are our HSE rules, health, safety, environment rules. So everyone knows them. So everyone works with them. Mm. And it doesn't come naturally. It has to be pounded in sometimes to get that understanding. And I think we are kind of at the same stage with data ethics and our personal data literacy and how we share and control our personal data. What are your takeaways? Or do you have a call to action, maybe?
So my key call to action on this would basically start revisit your data and have it saying why do we need it and what do we need it for, and then limit your data. So going back to this minimization of data instead of tracking everything. Yeah. So the action point would be stop tracking everything. You don't need everything. Most of it is not connected in any way to anything anyway. So focus on what you need, calibrate around that, and then build your ethic framework around that, because that will be a critical part of doing business.
Fantastic. Thank you.